Hello everybody and welcome to this, the latest episode of the Rewatch Project with Hannah and Mike. I am Mike and with me as always is Hannah. How are you tonight, Hannah?
Very well, thank you. It's not long since we last recorded.
It's not, actually. So this will probably be a very brief introduction, actually, because there's not really...
Well, we have zero feedback.
Well, I think I posted the episode yesterday.
Yeah.
This is a uncharacteristically quick turnaround for us for recording, but what the heck? I think it's because we do often record it Saturday night here in New Zealand.
Saturday night, the movie.
It is Saturday night at the TV rewatch, mm-hmm. and but we managed to get a weekday recording in earlier in the week.
Good.
So this is more of the, I guess this is the regular recording, but here we are. We're back. We're talking Twin Peaks. We are on the ninth episode of season two. Mm-hmm. So we're almost at the halfway mark for the season. Hannah, what is the episode we are talking about tonight specifically?
Well, it's unofficially called mm-hmm. Arbitrary Law.
Yep.
That make it move when I say unofficially.
This is stirring.
Plot synopsis says, Albert returns to examine Maddie. Cooper asks for 24 hours to finish his case. James and Donna reaffirm their love. Andy accidentally leads Donna and Cooper back to Mrs. Tremond's house. It is directed by Tim Hunter and written by Mark Frost, Harley Payton, and Robert Engels.
Awesome. So some key names from the show there. And this is a, it's a biggie, this one. So we're looking forward to it.
Yeah, let's get into it.
All right. Well, we appreciate feedback, as always, when we give you time to actually send any at rewatchprojectpodcast@gmail.com. And it's a D-mail. That's the private one.
That's the OnlyFans version.
Yeah, that's it.
D-mail.
Send it to my D-mail. rewatchprojectpodcast@gmail.com. And also, you can leave comments on the YouTube channel as well, if you so wish. And we will read those out as feedback if they feel appropriate to do so. And we are on Twitter and Instagram at rewatchproj. That's P-R-O-J. And also, please check out our friend shows, namely Gin Stroker versus Punter, His Film, Her Movie, The Good, The Bad and The Odd, Talk Without Rhythm podcast, Film Bastards, and Video Game Landfill. And we also appreciate reviews on Apple Podcasts and on Spotify. So should we get into it?
Let's do it.
All right. We'll be back shortly to give our initial reactions and then a little walkthrough and review and riff on said episode. So we should be back very soon.
Very soon.
I couldn't decide whether to go for soon or shortly, and I ended up being Sean Connery.
Well, at least you didn't say shortly.
Shortly. Well, yeah, I think that probably would have been better.
Good afternoon, good morning, good evening, and welcome to Film Bastards, a podcast where three friends, two of them married and two of them podcasting life partners, chat everything from new releases, trailers, news, and an eclectic mix of other film goodies. Oh, and many, many, many tangents. You can find them by searching your podcast provider or check them out on Twitter and Instagram by searching Film Bastards. You never know, you might like it. And if you don't, well, we don't really give a f***.
And we're back. So we've just finished watching Twin Peaks, episode 9 of season 2.
Round of applause for Ray Wise.
Yes. Good work there, sir.
Go to the light.
Yes. You have earned the right to go to the light. So, yes, we've just finished watching Arbitrary Law, the most arbitrarily titled episode.
Yes.
And Hannah, initial thoughts before we break it down.
Just a stunning performance from Ray Wise. I think that's the overriding feeling I come away from this episode with. Everything else is secondary to his performance in this episode. That's not to say anyone did a bad job.
I slightly disagree with you there, but I'll get to that.
Not
about his performance was wonderful, but I think there's a lot of other great stuff in this episode.
There is a lot of other great stuff, and I'm not saying there's not, but his, for me, is the standout performance.
Yeah, that's fair.
I love I really love Albert in this episode and how he gives Cooper that confidence to trust his gut.
Yeah.
And it's almost a bit like going back to his for want of a less Sharon Stone phrase, basic instinct.
Yeah. Well, it feels a lot more like season three, Albert.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. I just really enjoyed it. And seeing Ray Wise as Bob and as Leland was really great.
I mean, you could argue that maybe this is the first time we've actually seen the real Leland in the whole show.
Yeah, yeah.
If that's the reading you subscribe to, of course.
Well, I think once you've heard Cooper's explanation of, you know, the manic dancing, and then when he kills Jacques Renault, how his hair turns white, it's almost like he's progressively more Bob.
Yeah.
So perhaps there was some Leland at the start. And
again, it's a little bit like in season three when Cooper, the possessed by Bob Cooper, starts taking on some of the physical, like his hair, he grows his hair long and, you know, he's wearing leather jackets and he's starting to actually physically take on the appearance of Bob as well. And that's, I suppose that's kind of what's been happening to Leland as well.
It was fabulous. And special mention for Andy, who provided some much needed light relief in this episode. I loved when he called Dick Tremaine at the menswear and Lucy's like getting all fizzy at seeing him, you know.
But it's also, I think, Johnny a genuinely sad scene with Andy as well when he said, "The I am a lonely soul."
Yeah.
And he's obviously talking about himself.
Yeah, of course he is. But, you know, when he's doing the Johnny Big Potatoes saying, you know, "I want you to come down," and then goes, "As long as you're free."
Yeah, because he's at the beginning, he's like, "Tremaine, it's Brennan."
Yeah.
Yeah.
Andy Brennan. Just you see the kind of, no. Lucy's face.
She wanted him to fight.
Over it was good. What about you?
I really like it. It's interesting because, I mean, for all the reasons that you've said, but I also think this episode stylistically kind of stands alone. I think that although there are Lynchian moments, I feel like Tim Hunter brings elements of his own to this episode. Like there's some visual stuff in this episode that feels really unique to this episode.
Just speaking to that. A lot of blue.
Yeah, there is. There's a lot, a bit of blue for the dads.
The blue.
And there's loads of...
This is the only episode I've noticed that in.
There's loads of Dutch angles, if you will.
A Dutch angle.
But there are. I mean, you must have noticed that there's lots of kind of almost comic book framing. And also, it almost feels sort of cinematographically different. There's a kind of softness. To the way, like, I think, you know, the scene between James and Donna near the beginning when, you know, they've obviously had sex for the first time the night before. That's the subtext of the scene. And they're sitting in, it doesn't even look like the diner or the roadhouse. I'm not even sure where they are.
No, I didn't think it was the diner to start. It's almost like it was.
But it looks, the whole scene's got this kind of, to quote George Costanza, it's got a pinkish hue. You know?
It looks a bit like it's got Vaseline on the lens.
Yeah, a lot of the episode does. Mm. And I kind of like that because there's a sub-aesthetic of Twin Peaks that's very much in line with Douglas Sirk movies and, you know, Peyton Place and All That Heaven Allows and those kind of, you know, Rock Hudson films.
Mm.
And this episode feels like it really hones in on that element particularly because that's like a sort of been a subtler element throughout the whole of Twin Peaks, but this episode really doubles down on it, and I like all of that stuff. But also, watching it this time, it's funny because I feel that the episode two episodes ago, the Lynch directed episode, when we watched that, I said that I felt like that was David Lynch's ending of the Laura Palmer storyline.
Yeah.
This feels like the Mark Frost ending of the storyline. Yeah. So whereas the Lynch ending was ambiguous and all about feeling, this was about information.
Yeah.
And was about
resolution.
Was a very traditional Poirot, Sherlock Holmes, you know, the killer is in this room. So in the way that Lynch resists talking about his films, I mean, I'm watching a documentary about Twin Peaks at the moment and Lynch isn't in it. There's footage of him, but it's all archival. You know, he's got this kind of suspicion around and hesitance to discuss meaning. What this episode literally, there's a scene where Cooper goes through all of the abstractions of his dream and gives them literal meaning.
Yeah.
So it almost feels like, and you get this in season three, the penultimate episode of season three is very much Mark Frost's ending, you know, and then the final episode is David Lynch's ending.
Yeah.
You could watch the whole of Twin Peaks The Return and end at the end of the penultimate episode, and it's a completely satisfying ending. It's a happy ending.
Yeah.
And then the Lynch's final episode feels like the beginning of something else. Something else that I think he's going to get made. It's this unrecorded night project that there's been a lot of word about. And it's really interesting rewatching this episode based on season three. And I'll get to it when we get there, but there's a significant moment in this episode that I didn't really think that much of when I originally watched Twin Peaks, that has incredible resonance in the third season. The very ending of the third season is following up on a moment from this episode, which is kind of interesting as well. But I really like this episode, but I just think that this episode is as satisfying as episode seven was, but for the part of the brain that craves pattern recognition and, you know, and logic. Whereas the seventh episode is for, you know, people who enjoy sensation, you know.
Yeah, clear answers is what you want to watch this episode for.
Yeah, I mean, if I've said before that episode seven gave you a sense of understanding, whereas this gives you a sense of explanation.
And that's kind of verbalised in the ending of this episode when they're all talking in the woods about whether Bob was real or not real. And when Cooper says, you know, what sits better with you, that Bob was real or that Leland raped and murdered his daughter?
Which is better?
You know, it sort of doesn't matter either way in the end. You know, it's just still not good at the end of the day.
And I also think, I remember at the time when people said that they felt that the X-Files was a bit of a knockoff of Twin Peaks. This is the Twin Peaks that I think they were talking about, this type of episode.
Mm.
Like the conversation in the woods at the end, that could be an episode of the X-Files. You know, it really feels like those sort of philosophical conversations.
What does it all mean?
Every episode of the X-Files has that scene in it, you know.
An element of that scene.
Yeah, and it's, you know, they're standing around in a Pacific Northwest looking woods in their FBI garb discussing, you know, is it really, you know, it's an inevitable comparison. But but I just think that this is one of those episodes where we've spoke also about how there's been this sense of like shit getting real. And it feels like this is the episode where, you know, at the beginning, Cooper's like, right, I just need 24 hours. And it's satisfying when a show can just kind of release the handbrake completely.
It sort of feels like this is the episode that you can smoke a cigarette after.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, the show could have ended with this.
Yes, yeah.
You know, and there'd have been a few storylines hanging, but that's just the nature of the soap opera. And that's why I've said before, I think it's really interesting that Lynch chose to end season three with a new beginning, because it's a circle, it's a cycle, it's a soap opera, it's never ending. It's a golden ring, you know, it's that whole idea. So I think Lynch wants you, when you have finished watching all of Twin Peaks, when you finish season three, not to go, what a satisfying experience that was. He wants you to put the pilot on.
Yeah.
Afterwards, because the pilot's the next episode.
Yeah.
Because it goes round and around. Of course, yeah. And I remember at the time, at the end of season three, being slightly disappointed. Like, oh, God, I thought there was going to be some closure. But then I remember a couple of days later thinking, why on earth did I, for a second, like for 30 years, I've been talking about Twin Peaks being this endless loop of events. Why did I think that suddenly Lynch was just going to,
you know, tie it in a bow?
Yeah, and that's one of those things where it would have been great at the time, but you'd have hated yourself in the morning.
Yeah.
You know, it would have been one of those, I'd have been slightly disappointed if Lynch had done that. I mean, he gave Mark Frost that penultimate episode.
It would have been the Kit Lama.
It would have TV been. Endings. And I mean, I think if you asked Mark Frost what the ending of Twin Peaks was, he would tell you it was the penultimate episode of season three. I mean, that final episode.
It'd be really good if you could talk to him again.
Yeah, I'd be really curious. He's not really talked much about season three. I'd be really curious to know how that all works. Mm. But should we get into into the breakdown of it? Because there's a lot of very specific moments here. So we've got the moment that I was taking a note about was, it says Piper Laurie as Tojimara and Catherine Martell on the opening credits at the end. Because, of course, she hasn't been credited at all on the credits, because it would have been a spoiler, not even tucked away on the end. So I'm assuming she got paid, but I don't know how that works from a union perspective. So we open up with all of the characters, you know, walking in a line, and it feels very cop show. It feels a lot like the old TV show The Untouchables, you know, Elliot Ness and his mobster busters. It feels very much like a kind of 1950s, like the FBI story, you know, the Jimmy Stewart movie, and very old Hollywood depictions of like US Marshals or federal agents. You know, it feels like they're trying to elicit that. And as I said, Tim Hunter very much goes for kind of a pulpish style. You know, those, because what you can't, whenever you see Dutch angles in something, you instantly think either German expressionistic filmmaking of early cinema, or comic books. You know, that's what those angles sort of do. And there's no real meaning behind it. It's not like one of those techniques that creates an obvious effect. Like, you know, handheld creates a sense of chaos, for example.
Yeah.
It is very much kind of style for style's sake. But I quite like it, because this is kind of a special episode, a very special episode in some ways.
Tonight, on a very special Twin Peaks.
Yeah, that's it. It's like the... it feels that, because I've heard some criticisms of this episode where people have said, oh, you know, it's kind of weird for weird's sake. But I don't think it is. I think it's that because this episode is so important narratively, it feels like it needs some kind of special treatment.
Yeah.
Almost. And I think that the slightly different type of cinematography and the angular stuff is just to create a sense that it's important.
Yeah.
You know, or at the very least, kind of singular. So we find the letter O under Maddie's finger.
And Cooper's reluctant to inform anyone. Like, his instincts are telling him not to let anybody know that Maddie is dead, because... that's going to hinder finding out who it is rather than actually help.
And he never says it, but I get the feeling that when you see him at the end of episode 7 and he's in the roadhouse and he's kind of, you know, looking around, and it's almost like, I get the feeling in my mind what Cooper's thinking about there is when the dwarf said, where we are from, there's always music in the air. And it's because you can see him sort of listening to the Judy Cruz and looking around, you see the curtains. I almost feel that he understands that he's in the zone, that he's connected with something.
Mm.
And it's a little bit like, you know, when you wake up and you can remember your dream and you're trying to...
Piece it together.
Yeah, mm. But you know it's going to go.
Yeah.
I get the feeling that that's where Cooper's at.
Mm.
He understands that he's kind of connected the gears and he's in the sort of right kind of trench.
Mm.
So he has to move quickly whilst he's still got access to that intuition.
Yeah, absolutely. Sort of,
and
I'd agree with
that's
that.
The way he plays it. And I like the fact that that all goes unspoken. Like, he never talks to anyone in the show about his experience in the Roadhouse or what he saw, mm. almost because he doesn't want to break the spell. Mm. And it makes that a private, special thing between him and the audience as well, I think.
And I think there's also, like, as much as he says he doesn't know where to start when Albert's saying about following his instinct and, you know, do whatever he needs to do to get there, I think there is a part of him that instinctively knows it's Leland.
Yeah.
And it's just a case of, like, say, him connecting those dots from the dream and the...
If you take the kind of Jungian reading of it, you know, the idea being, of course, that when he had that dream in episode 3, Laura whispered to him, "My father killed me,"
mm.
and he heard it, but it's a dream, so he forgot it.
Mm.
And you know how when you forget anything, it could be a dream, something will happen that triggers the memory. You're like, "Oh, I've got it. It was this."
Yeah.
And Cooper is just trying to use his intuition to maneuver himself into a situation that shakes the memory loose.
Yeah.
You know? And that's what he finds at the Roadhouse through this random series of events
mm.
kind of coming together. And I really feel that I'm not a New Age person at all, but I do think that there is something about memory and about collective consciousness that isn't magic, but is just some neuroscience or something that we haven't quite figured out yet that is there, you know. And again, in transcendental meditation, they call it the collective field or the something field.
I don't know.
And the idea is that it is this kind of, and this is where I think where Lynch's fascination with ideas comes from. The idea is the thought of it is that when you have an idea, you're not creating that.
Mm.
You're finding that. It's a kind of the way that you look at these things.
Yeah.
So it's kind of like the
like an Easter egg hunt.
Yeah, yeah. It's that all ideas are out there in the universal collective field.
Mm.
And by being creative, and for some people that might be smoking weed or mm. it might be exercising or something, you do things and
to access those thoughts.
Yeah, and David Lynch always calls it catching the big fish.
Mm.
You know, he's like, when you have a really great idea, you've caught the big fish. You know, mm. it's like a beautiful thing. So I think that Cooper is very much a mouthpiece for, you know, Lynch's philosophy. And it's not a cynical thing. It's not like he's a Scientologist trying to recruit no. people or anything like that. I mean, transcendental meditation is about as offensive, unassuming a belief system as you can have, really, a belief. But it's definitely in the New Age tie-dye
mm.
kind of side of things, as opposed to the
like
Charles Manson kind of...
The baggy, stretchy pants and
child's pose. Yeah, hairy armpits kind of thing. You see Cooper looking at the white stuffed animal. I didn't want to mention this at the time, but it is crazy rewatching it, because you see about 3 or 4 episodes ago, when Leland goes back to work in Ben Horn's office, you see him sit there. Ben's talking to him. And, you know, when Leland does that whole, "Well, we'll just do this and do this."
Yeah.
And he's like, you see Leland look around at this stuffed animal and reach over and pull a bit of it off and put it in his pocket. And that's when Ben looks at him. He's like, "Leland, do you, you know, come on, mate, are you okay?" But it's crazy because it's episodes beforehand and it just seems like this weird little moment. But when you rewatch it, you're like, "Oh, that's Leland.
He's framing him.
He's starting to set Ben up here," you know. And it's just such a tiny little moment that you probably won't spot until like your third viewing.
Yeah.
But that's a nice touch. And again, what the rewatch project is all about, in a sense, is spotting those Easter eggs with hindsight, you know?
And, I mean, this for me is only really the second proper time I've watched this all through.
Yeah, so you must be having quite a lot of moments where you're like,
well, there's lots of stuff that I'd forgotten.
Yeah, well, of course, it's been years.
But, you know, there's also, it's mad the stuff that I've remembered. And, in fact, one of the things from this episode, obviously the big reveal scene is, you know, it sticks in your memory.
Which reveal scene, sorry?
Well, the cell scene when Leland's confessing to
you. Is that the scene you were referencing last week? Well, last time when you said that there's one scene that's really stuck in your memory from first watching.
From this episode, yeah. But just prior to it, like when they throw Leland in the cell and, you know, Bob's obviously going nuts and whatever, and he's sitting there with the handcuffs on and, you know, they're talking and what have you. I was sitting there thinking, I was sure that he was outside when that happened because it was raining, wasn't it? And then I see the smoke go up through thing and I was like, oh, of course it was.
Yeah, raining indoors.
Yeah. And it like rain and him lying on the ground talking about how he didn't remember doing all this terrible stuff and go to the light and all that, you know, that's what I remember.
Because for me, the scene, and not to take anything away of it and not to be my favourite bit versus your favourite bit, but the scene for this episode that's always stuck with me is the bit in the roadhouse.
Mm.
That's probably my Eye of the Duck scene on this episode.
Yeah.
But we'll get to it anyway.
Well, I mean,
we'll
get to both. Yeah, I mean, that's the more important scene.
I think the thing I like, the reason just, that resonates that, with me.
That's just the emotional bit that stayed
with
me.
I feel like that is the sort of the coming together of the Lynchian and the Frostian.
Mm.
You know, it's because you're seeing the Red Room and all of these strong, super Lynchian elements, but they're getting Mark Frosted.
I love that old bellhop dude.
Yeah.
I wish he was alive. I'm picking he's not.
I would imagine that, not. No.
Given that he's like, you know,
I mean, he was so old in Twin Peaks. Like, he was in a lot of really early westerns. Like, he was in movies when John Wayne was young.
Yeah.
And he always played either the town drunk, which was a classic western character.
Yeah.
Or he'd be the kind of comedy sidekick who would, like, ride a donkey next to John Wayne.
I just love the way he, like, waves and gives a thumbs up.
Yeah.
Like, I just want to give him a cuddle.
Yeah, well, he's kind of, you get the feeling that he's from this other place.
Yeah.
But I like the idea that you've got, you know, people like Bob who are just terrifying demonic characters. And then you've got, like, kind of crazed zealots like Mike. You've got kind of, I guess, morally ambiguous characters like the little man.
Mm.
And then you've just got kind of like these doofy characters like this guy. Like the idea that, like, he's almost like, I guess, Andy.
Yeah.
But, and the feeling I also get is that these people, they come into the world and they kind of can't quite be human.
Yeah.
Like, they haven't quite got it down.
No.
They're
sort of trying really hard, but, yeah.
And they, or something happens when they come in that fries them. And I guess that's Dougie in season 3.
Yeah.
Because he's like the bellhop. He just can barely function as a human being, but he's kind of endearingly doofy and kind of funny.
Yeah.
So that's another thing, weird sort of, and obviously, you know, the bellhop was introduced at length in an episode that David Lynch and Mark Frost steered. And, of course, every single episode of season 3 is written by Frost and Lynch, and every single episode is directed by David Lynch. So, you know, it's an undistilled view of it. So I do feel that Dougie Jones and the bellhop have had maybe similar kind of experiences or arcs in a lot of ways. That's a subplot I'm looking forward to rewatching again. Because when you watch that for the first time, bit of a tangent, we will get back to this episode, but when you watch season 3 for the first time, you're kind of willing him to be Cooper again.
Mm.
But I'm looking forward to rewatching it and knowing that that won't happen until like 2-3 quarters of the way through. and I can relax into just enjoying Dougie Jones.
Yeah.
And kind of loving him for who he is, not for who he isn't.
You know? I'm really excited to get to The Return because I've literally watched it once and I can, like you say things of, oh, that character comes back and that comes back and this thing, oh, this moment and blah, blah, blah. I'm like, I can barely fucking remember it.
You have to remember, though, is that I have only watched it once, but I would watch that week's episode and then listen to 15 podcasts all talking about it, and they'd rehash the plot, they'd go over it. I'd watch one
and then look after two under the age of three.
Yeah, yeah. And we were like, we were imbibing, weren't we, when we were...
And Philip would have been one and still waking up, oh, every 20 minutes overnight.
Yeah.
There were some nights that I just couldn't drive the next day because I hadn't slept.
Well, it's going to be interesting because I worked out in my head, so probably not that accurate, that we'll be hitting the Twin Peaks season 3 around the time we reach the modern X-Files episodes. So it's going to be really weird seeing these two 90s shows, but in like 4K, like modern TV style at the same time. And of course, David Duchovny is in season 3 of Twin Peaks as well.
Yeah.
So it's going to be really odd seeing these two very recent versions of these old shows at the same time. Yeah. It's kind of oddly perfect. A bit like finding out what happened to Mulder's sister as New Year's fireworks were going off on the...
That was how we brought in the new year.
I'm going to remember that for the rest of my life.
Yeah.
It was
really oddly perfect.
Well, like, the fireworks were going off just as that kind of that Moby score that they used, and all of the children were ascending, and it was weirdly beautiful. Actually,
it was really well timed.
It felt like a nice vibe to a cleansing thing.
Bring in the new year with some alien...
with some child murder. So we get Albert tell Cooper to catch this beast. And I think it's interesting because you know that for all of his personality flaws, Cooper clearly respects Albert.
Yes.
You know, and it's funny as well because I didn't mention this at the time, but in, I think, the pilot episode of Twin Peaks... Cooper's talking into his dictaphone whilst looking under Laura Palmer's fingernail, and Truman's there. And he says to Diane, oh, don't put Sam on this. Put Albert on it. Sam's good, but Albert's got more on, is more on the ball.
Mm.
So he's obviously making...
Yeah, we talked about that.
Yeah, so he's talking about that. But do you know who Sam is? No. Sam is the character...
Oh, isn't it Kiefer Sutherland?
Yeah.
You mentioned that.
Oh, did I? Oh, okay, yeah. And he plays him really kind of doofy.
Yeah.
So I love the fact that when Lynch was writing Fire Walk With Me and decided to have Sam on, he thought, shit, I've got to be consistent with how Cooper describes the character in that one line of dialogue in the pilot episode. But with all the stuff about Albert being, you know, a real douchebag, it shouldn't be a surprise that when it comes down to it, ultimately, he wants to stop the bad guy.
Mm.
But also I think part of that is that epiphany he had with the speech that he gave, of course, to Truman.
Mm.
You know, I live in the company of Gandhi and King, you know, and the basis of that is love, you know. And so what you see is that all of Albert's awful personality traits come from just his bullheaded pursuit of justice.
Yeah.
You know, so in the same way that Cooper is kind of one-tracked when it comes to that, Albert kind of is in his own shittier way, I guess. Yeah. Cooper says he needs 24 hours. We get the scene with James and Donna. I love the awkwardness of that scene, the way that when he gives her the ring, he's like, I don't know what size your fingers are. And the woman in the shop had really big hands.
Really fat fingers.
And We get a scene of Norma's mum being horrible and judgy about her omelette, which, in fairness, the omelette doesn't look very nice.
Well, I'm crap at making omelettes, so anyone who makes an omelette is all right in my eyes.
We see Andy doing the I'm a Lonely Soul, and Donna makes the connection. She talks about mentions Mrs. Tremond, the elderly lady and the magician grandson. I like the way that Andy just goes straight back to saying the poem again after they leave. You know, that's a very Lynchian feeling moment. Donna takes Cooper to see Mrs. Tremond. And this is what I love about the fact that at the very end of, spoiler alert, of season three, when, you know, you learn that Cooper has essentially gone back in time and saved Laura Palmer's life.
Yeah.
And then he goes off and finds Laura. She's lived this other life and she's an adult now. And he takes her back to her house to be reunited with her mum. Mm. And her mum's not there. It's a Mrs. Tremond.
Yeah.
She's like, nobody of that name lives here. So whatever's happened here, so what this big confusing moment is at the end of season three, that's the ending of the show, has already happened. You've seen it happened here. So obviously this is just almost like the spirit world or whatever doing a cleanup operation.
Yeah.
You know, a bit like the, what do you call it, the observers in Fringe. Yeah. You know, it feels like they just go and they just get rid of a whole part of reality or something and it's gone. So I remember when that woman came to the door about at the end of season three, about a beat before she said it, I was like, she's going to be a Tremond, isn't she? You know, and these weird people who come in and just sort of, you know, or maybe they're the real people and that the Palmers were the interlopers, you know, it's just, it opens up a hot, it's asking more questions like a good soap opera should be doing. So she's left a note for Donna. And I love the way that they read the diary, obviously, and Laura explains that she had the same dream. And this means, this is great, because it, what that means is that when you get to Fire Walk With Me, Fire Walk With Me is a prequel and a sequel to the series because of that lack of time. So you see Laura writing about Cooper and having experiences with Cooper in Fire Walk With Me, even though it's set before Laura even died.
Yeah.
You know, so they get to do a lot of fun stuff there as well. But I love, and it's a great choice from the writers and the director and from Carl McLachlan, that when he explains that he had the same dream, Andy's like, that's impossible. And Cooper's like, yes, it is. Yeah. And looks kind of happy about that. He's just like, yep, it is impossible.
It's impossible.
So I must be on the right track then, because all of this is just impossible.
Yeah, the more incredulous people are, the better the line is.
Yeah, it's a good sign, isn't it?
Yeah.
And the diary says that Bob is only afraid of one man and his name is Mike. And Laura wonders whether that's Mike in her dream. But, of course, we know it's Cooper from the beginning of season three, like old Coop. He goes to see Mike. He talks about a golden circle and he's like, you know, my ring. And he talks about the giants. Mike says, you know, he is known to us. And this is where Cooper sees the bellhop, who again does the I know about you, and the milk is getting cool.
Warmer.
You're getting warmer. So obviously Cooper's like, oh, okay, this is definitely, I'm getting warmer, you know. We see Catherine in her disguise go to see Ben.
Gets her little piggly wiggly toes out.
I love how Ben just goes into politician mode. You know, he's just talking about how, you know, dark night of his soul, and
wait to breathe the fresh air of freedom.
It's whatever. The my gran always used to call it talking loud and saying nothing.
Yeah,
you know, a bit like podcasts, I guess. And but I love the way that his initial response is to kiss her feet.
Yeah,
because he doesn't care,
and he is kind of like, well played.
Yeah, you know. He loves it. Like when he sees her, he's like, Catherine. You're in a frigging disguise. He's like, we're doing that now? Like, I didn't even realise that was on the table, disguises. Yeah. Like, I'd have done that years ago if I'd have known we did that.
Yeah.
It's almost like he's seeing, like, the wonderful future possibilities of their, you know, sparring. Yeah. And I like the way that when she says you've got to sign all this stuff over, and he's just like, in a heartbeat, I'll do it. I also love the way that when he's freaking out, he's kind of wiping the bars with his hanky before grabbing it. He's like, he's still trying to maintain this sense of civility.
Yeah.
Despite the fact
I like her line about, we've been lying to each other for years, why spoil it with the truth now?
Absolutely.
Such a good line.
We see Donna go to see Leland, mm-hmm. and he grabs a glass of lemonade for her. She's gone to get the tape of their...
it's the orangest lemonade I've ever seen.
She's wearing her sunglasses as well and talks about the family diary. And I love the kind of the thinking that you can see Ray Wise doing in this scene, mm-hmm. you know. And, you know, obviously there's a huge amount of tension in this scene because you're starting to, you're like, okay, we know where how this goes. Mm. You know, he puts on
an interesting
dinner jazz. And
I did think it was interesting, given that Donna kind of... clicked into the vibe, you know, she felt the sadness when Maddie was being killed.
Yeah.
That she didn't see Leland as Bob.
Yeah, and it's interesting because when you see her after the scene, and I love it, I love the moment when she's crying walking down the road straight after the scene. That's one of those great, nothing's actually happening, but it's just brilliant filmmaking and performance moments. And when I first saw it, I thought she was crying because she's like, wow, Leland's the murderer.
Yeah.
But what she's actually crying about is that she's realised that Maddie's dead.
Yeah.
And I almost feel like...
I 100% thought she was like, oh my God.
What am I going to do?
Leland killed Laura. Yeah. I nearly died.
And I almost feel like she kind of on some level knows that, but she's so traumatised. Like, Maddie being dead kind of overrides everything almost.
Yeah.
If the doorbell hadn't rang, things would have gone very badly for her.
Yeah. And Sheriff Truman, so, you know, things are fine.
Yeah. And thinking about what you were saying in the last episode about how you get the feeling that Leland, it's not that he wants to get caught, but he's having fun kind of waving it in their faces.
Mm.
And there's a couple of moments in this scene as well where he says, we'll work it out together. And he's looking in the mirror as Bob.
Mm.
And he's like, can we have this dance? You know, there's obviously a double meaning to that. You know, meaning, you know, can him and Bob have this dance?
Well, can him and Leland have this dance?
Well, yeah.
He's Bob.
Yeah. So we see, you know, obviously James can't handle the pain.
Oh, he's got so much pain.
Yeah. So he has to go off on his bike. We move into the roadhouse and we see Ben Horn's there, Leland's there, and he asks if someone's meeting us. Ed turns up, Leo and Bobby turn up, and Cooper says, you know, the killer is in this room. And I love the, you know, I've used FBI guidelines, deductive techniques, Tibetan technique, but I find myself in need of something new, which, for want of a better word, we'll call magic. And then you get the flash of lightning at exactly the moment that he does it. And then it makes sense that Major Briggs would be there. Of all of the people, it kind of had to be Major Briggs that brought him in because he's
I like the
log lady.
I like the fact that it's the old man who's brought him there. Mm. You know, like it's another sign that he is from the other place.
The bellhop?
The bellhop, yeah. Because he's brought Major Briggs to this event.
Yeah. Well, it was more that he got Major Briggs to bring him to it.
Yeah, but it's kind of implied that he's...
I mean, I think the point of it, my reading is that he is, you know, from another place.
Mm.
The bellhop, and he knew that the time was right to go there to provide the last few subconscious clues to Cooper to push him over the edge. But I think the fact that the show chose Major Briggs of all people to be the person who brought him there kind of validates Briggs as being one of the kind of soldiers of light of the show. Because, you know, the Bookhouse Boys, like, if you look at their logo, because they've got, like, a logo, it's just like a sword against the woods. Like, you know, it's kind of got a Arthurian element absolutely. To it.
Yeah.
I mean, you've got, like, Glastonbury Grove and all that stuff later on in the show. So the feeling that you get is that people like Truman and Briggs and Albert and Cooper and Gordon Cole, and you'll see this a lot in the chess game with Windham Earl, are kind of knights in the Arthurian sense of the word, fighting for the light. They're trying to remind the audience that Briggs kind of moves in that world as well.
One thing I can't remember, because I've got a terrible memory these days, when did you first hear about the chewing gum you like is coming back in style?
That was in the third episode of the first season, the Little Man. One of the first things is that gum you like is going to come back in style.
Right.
That was one of the abstract clues that he gave Cooper.
In the dream?
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
I thought that was the case, but I couldn't visualise it.
And of course, because when Twin Peaks was first on, I was rewatching it and rewatching it as it went on. Mm. So by the time you get the shot of Donna and Leland gets the gum out and starts chewing it, I was, you know, Leo pointing me at the screen because I was like, oh, gum, that's what the little man said, you know. Mm. So by the time you get to the roadhouse and that's made literal, I was like, yeah, I've got no life. I've watched Twin Peaks about 30 times. And it's funny, I forgot to mention this earlier on, actually. I've just triggered the memory here. A bit like Cooper in many ways. But one thing about the experience of watching Twin Peaks in England, it was on, I think it was Tuesday nights at 9 on BBC Two. It's definitely a weeknight. But one of the things that was indicative of what a phenomena it was, was it was always on after a long-running TV show called Food and Drink, which was like a cookery show, and they reviewed wine, and it was like a kind of lifestyle show on BBC Two. And I remember I'd always see like the last 10 minutes of Food and Drink because I'd be waiting for Twin Peaks to be on.
Yeah.
And I remember before, I think it was the first episode of season two, they were doing Twin Peaks themed stuff. Like they were teaching you how to make cherry pie and, you know, how best to brew a good coffee and all this. So it was kind of permeating into these sort of like other areas. And I think to get the full perspective on the show, you kind of need to know that was all that kind of pop cultural ephemera was happening as well. Cooper says that the killer is in the room. We see the bellhop offer some gum. And Lena says, that's my most favourite gum. I loved this when I was a child. And the bellhop says that gum you like is going to come back in style. And this is where Cooper hears Laura, or remembers hearing Laura say, my father killed me.
Mm.
We see the giant appear and gift Cooper his ring back, as though to suggest that he's completed his task.
Yeah.
This is where Cooper says that we're going to take Ben back and asks Leland to come as his attorney, which if you think about it, for any time at all, makes no sense.
Mm.
And this is a classic bit of Twin Peaks logic. And I think one of the reasons why it's great that this episode feels so otherworldly, in what world would would the father of a murder victim defend the person being charged with the murder of his daughter? It makes absolutely no sense.
But in a way, I think it's kind of implying that Cooper knows that Leland is currently Bob.
Oh, I understand why he's got Leland to do it.
Yeah, yeah. But, like, Bob wouldn't cop on to the fact that, oh, that wouldn't make sense to me.
Yeah, I mean, my headcanon for this, aside from the fact that it's Twin Peaks and this shit ultimately doesn't really matter, you know, the show's got its own logic, there might be some legality that he has to have a lawyer present in order to be able to be charged.
Mm.
And they live in the arse end of nowhere, where apart from Leland, Jerry Horn is like the only alternative.
And he's off trying to find somebody else.
Exactly. So, and they've already established, you know, that they have to get like a kind of a judge on wheels to come in to do all of that.
Yeah.
So I can kind of hand wave that. And I think it shows how deft the show is that you don't really think about that the first time that you watch it. In the same way that you don't think about the realities of the passage of time, you know, you accept that. You feel like, well, the show's been on for a year in the real world, so a year's passed on the show. That's what it feels like.
Yeah.
You know, actresses' hair has grown. I mean, Sharon and Ben had short hair in the pilot.
Yeah.
And, like, she's got shoulder-length hair.
Yeah.
And it's meant, you know, so...
And it's supposed to have been, like, 3 weeks.
Yeah. So there's a kind of cognitive dissonance that you just sort of accept. I love the moment where I've used this as a gif many times when Cooper gives the thumbs up to the gang when he walks out. It's a great image, great screensaver. I'm glad that the episode is coming out soon. The whole of Twin Peaks coming out soon on 4K. So I can get a high resolution screen grab of that for future use. We go back to the station and they do the old switcheroo.
Yeah.
Where, you know, we see Cooper whisper to Truman. And I love the fact that Ben Horn's there, like when they push him in, and Ben's just like, Leland? And Hawk's like, oh, that's not Leland. And I love how unnerved Hawk looks.
He looks terrified.
The
whole
of that. He's just... I think he's almost the only one in the scene who I think actually fully gets the gravity. Like, he looks like they've got the devil in the room. Like, he's just like, I'm not. And you can see again in season three that even, like, you know, 30 years later, he's still kind of haunted by that, like, 3 weeks of his life in the early 90s, you know. You know, he says that's not Leland. And Cooper says to Truman, you know, Truman's like, how did you know? And Cooper gives him a bunch of mumbo jumbo, and Truman's like, well, I'm going to need more than that.
Mm.
And Cooper's like, well, how about a confession? And I love the way that they've got him tied to the chair, and Hawk's just got his gun on him.
Yeah.
But like, they are not taking any chances with this guy.
Absolutely.
And you've got, and this is where you get some great stuff from, because obviously you've got the wonderful emotional scene when, you know, Bob's, as he says, he's pulled that ripcord and all of Leland's memories have come flooding back. At least that's, you know, if that's the narrative that you're buying here. But I really like the scene where he gets to go full Jack Nicholson, you know.
Yeah.
And he's kind of like cackling and just hooting and just full on. Like, Bob's just like, finally, I can be me. Like, he's, I could bring the whole me to work, you know?
Yeah, he's so brilliant in that scene.
And the thing is, he can do the really big stuff, but he can do the small stuff as well. You know, he can do the real quiet moments.
Mm.
And it's funny because, I mean, Ray Wise now, he doesn't look any older, and he's still got, he's had such a great career and looks exactly the same as he did when he did Twin Peaks. Mm. It's really surreal. Like, he has a very small role in season three of Twin Peaks. And I remember people thought, oh, they've used some outtake footage. Just like, no, that's just what Ray Wise looks like in 2017. So, you know, he's cackling. Hawk looks terrified. I think one of the really effective moments in this as well is when, you know, did you kill Teresa Banks as well? And it's like, gee, well, you know, gee whiz, I guess I sort of did kill her. I've got a thing about knives, just like you that time in Pittsburgh, Coop.
Mm.
And the way that Cooper just steps back and he's just like, shit. Like, you know, that, and as an audience, you don't even know what he's talking about, but you know, you're like, oh, Cooper's spooked.
Yeah.
That must be really, this must have some significance. You know?
Yeah.
And he talks about pulling the ripcord and the smoke detector goes off. And I love the fact that you've got all this stuff going on, but they take a bit of time for like Dick Tremaine. You know? I mean, that's the fact that, and I've said it before and I'll say it again, is that one of the things that I love about Twin Peaks and I love about David Lynch is they're not above just being dumb sometimes and just doing dumb stuff. And, you know, I mean, again, people make fun of season two because of all the sort of, you know, Dick and Andy stuff. But I tell you what, people missed it when Fire Walk With Me came out and it was just all darkness.
Yeah.
You know, and none of that stuff that was happening. And I think that's why a lot of people responded really well to season three, because it kind of had both.
Mm.
You know, you had that kind of the level of darkness of Fire Walk With Me, because it was a cable show, it wasn't a network show, so they were able to get away with that stuff. But it was balanced with all the other stuff. Mm. But I think that, you know, when Lynch made the decision that Fire Walk With Me was going to be the last 7 days of Laura Palmer, you can't really do comedy.
No, that, you know? Yeah, absolutely.
Although there is some stuff in Fire Walk With Me that I think is very funny, but you've got to have a pretty dark, you know, sense of humour for it. Mm. And so Cooper lays out the dream clues. And I think, I mean, that's a satisfying scene for anybody who craves answers. You know, like, he pretty much goes through every line. Like, I think because some of them obviously were answered already.
Mm.
You know, like what when Laura in the dream says her arms bend back, we learn that's the way she was tied.
Yeah.
And so I think that it pretty much every single abstract line in that dream now has been given a literal answer.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah, it has.
And I think that that's one of the things that people who love Twin Peaks and then watch David Lynch's film struggled with is that the explanations are Mark Frost, the questions are David Lynch.
Yeah.
And I think that when people would then go and watch Lost Highway or Mulholland Drive or, you know, Inland Empire. It's all
Q and no A.
Yeah, yeah, is that it? Yeah. Yeah. So they were very much kind of like, oh, shit, okay, so I've got to kind of come up with my own readings for this. Mm. It's a little bit like going around, you know, people who maybe go around an art gallery with, you know, those sort of like phone things that you hold up that kind of tells you everything.
Yeah.
But then,
and this this represents this. This means yeah, yeah, that. Yeah. But that's like, what I need.
Yeah, yeah. But then they're like, oh, shit, I've got to go around and just look at the pictures. Like, you know, what
does, what do you mean I've got to think for myself and decide what it means
but
to
the,
me?
But the odd thing about David Lynch, though, is he's inconsistent because in season three there's insane stuff. But then there's other stuff where the characters will literally sit down and talk about it and explain it.
Yeah.
But again, I suppose that's the Mark Frost thing.
Yeah.
I think because season three feels so much more Lynchian.
Yeah.
And is. And I think the other thing as well is the impression I got from speaking to Mark Frost and from other interviews I've seen with him. I was watching an interview with him today. Is I think that Mark Frost is a lot weirder than people realise he is.
Yeah, I think he is too.
It's really tempting and easy, and I've done this, to take a kind of Lennon and McCartney view of it.
Yeah.
And to just go, well, McCartney did all the pretty stuff and Lennon did all the weird stuff, you know? It's like, no, Lennon could write some really beautiful love songs as well. Like, he wrote, like, Jealous Guy and, like, you know, stuff like that. And Paul McCartney could be a bit of a freak sometimes as well, you know, when he wanted to be. And I think it's like that. I think some of the really weird shit in Twin Peaks that I'd always attributed to Lynch actually did come from Mark Frost.
Mm.
Yeah, it's tempting to kind of be reductive.
Well, there's a reason that they work well together.
Yeah.
You know, I don't think you could put two people together who had absolutely nothing in common just because one was more about a vibe and one was more about answers to questions. You know, yeah. Like, you have to have crossover between two collaborators.
Yeah.
So there's got to be a bit of structure to Lynch and a bit of vagueness to Frost.
Yeah, and I think the thing is that I almost see it in the same way that you know, you've got rock stars and then you've got producers.
Mm.
And like the rock stars, you know, get to be all bohemian and kind of cool. And the producers are the ones that make the records sound the way that they sound and make them successful. But nobody gives a shit what they look like. They can have short hair and wear jumpers and it doesn't matter, you know. But Motley Crue have to look like Motley Crue.
Yeah.
You know, that's the thing. And it was funny because I asked Mark Frost about this. I was like, you know, is it to your sort of chagrin that you don't get that? And he was just like, we got paid the same.
Mm.
He's like, my bank account tells me that I'm fine. Yeah.
And, you know, he's not without the recognition. Like, you know, I know people tend to go on the Lynchian side of things, but, you know,
everybody knows it's Mark Frost.
Yeah, like it's never been hidden. It's not like Lynch goes around talking about it like he was the only one involved in it, which is sort of how I feel like Ricky Gervais sometimes goes about with The Office.
Yeah, yeah, totally, totally. Yeah. And it's interesting as well because what both Lynch and Frost have said is that Mark Frost wrote two Peaks books and they were written and released just before the third season, and there's one of them is an entire history of the town, and another one is a dossier written by the female FBI agent from season three, and it basically fills in all the blanks between season two and season three of Twin Peaks. It's written by Mark Frost, so it's basically Twin Peaks season 2.5.
Yeah,
it's a full-on book, and Lynch wasn't involved in that at all. And Mark Frost wasn't involved in Fire, Water, Me at all.
Right.
So there's almost a feeling that Twin Peaks seasons 1, 2 and 3 are the only pure canon Twin Peaks.
Mm.
And that Fire Walk With Me is David Lynch's view of Twin Peaks.
Mm.
And the books are Mark Frost's view of them. But when they work together, that's the real shit.
That's when it really happens.
So it is kind of interesting to see that they both had their chance to kind of take the show out for a spin independently.
Mm.
And Mark Frost's version is very narrative.
Yeah.
It's very literal. It's very kind of, this is what happened to the characters, you know.
Mm.
Whereas like Lynch's version is like, you know, Laura dreaming that she's in some weird house and walking through upside down doors for 15 minutes with mad music playing, you know, whereas like Mark Frost's is, this is what happened to Donna Haywood when she left Twin Peaks and she moved to Hollywood. And, you know, it's very much kind of like laying it out. My next note says, time for Dick.
Should have put, it's time for D-mail.
D-mail. I love the way that, first of all, Dick Tremaine has a cigarette holder. Of course he does. And I love the way that he asks, it's a great little bit of staging. He asks Andy for a light. And Andy spends ages looking for one and then just goes, no. And then I like the way that Dick then just produces a lighter like he had one all along. He just wanted to inconvenience Andy.
Well, the way he gives a little giggle, like he knows that Andy's not going to have one.
Yeah, he just sort of my young friends.
He's being a dickhead.
And when they see, they're looking at Leland in the room. Truman's like, Leland's just crazy, right? And then Leland does the Fire Walk With Me, and he does the additional, I'll catch you with my death bag. You may think I've gone insane, but I promise I will kill again. And that's when the sprinklers go off, or it starts raining outdoors, if you're Hannah's memory, which is purely logical. And Bob basically smashes Leland's head in, because I think the idea, of course, is that he has to destroy the body to escape, or he just figured, I'll slam the door on the way out. That's when, you know, Leland's like, I killed her. And it's interesting, it's a complicated scene, because I think you've got, you know, just the excellence of the performance, the fact that if you do see Leland as a victim, you know, then it's nice to see a sense of redemption, and you see Cooper being very calm about it.
Mm.
Or you could see, if your view is that it's metaphorical and that it's about the idea of generational abuse, you know, oh, he came to me when I was just a boy, then it's more complex and potentially problematic, because you could say, well, it is a tragedy when anybody, particularly, you know, obviously children, are the victims of abuse. Is the show letting Leland off the hook because he was a victim of abuse, you know, and should it? And then, but then you've got the complexity of, like, is that what it's even saying? Is it sugarcoating? You know, and I think there is a really complex conversation there. And honestly, I feel like I could probably convincingly argue either side. So I think you've just got to, like, pick your lane on that one. But I think that it is a really powerful sequence. I think that it's a really amazing performance.
I think Cooper is wonderful for Leland in the scene. You know, like, because in my mind, Bob is real.
Yeah.
And
I'm tempted to take it at face value.
Leland is a victim of him.
Yeah.
Just as much as Laura was.
I think that, that Leland, this episode, was just
a vessel that he worked through.
I think that that's what the show is telling us. Now, and when I say the show, and this is where I think I differ from people like Mark from The Good, The Bad and The Odd, is that I still maintain Twin Peaks is a very collaborative show. It does have showrunners, but this episode, you know, David Lynch's name isn't on this episode. I mean, obviously he was a co-showrunner, so who knows how much or little involvement he had. I think you'd have to be there, or, you know, I don't know. That information is probably out there somewhere. But, you know, I think this episode, you know, written by Mark Frost, Robert Engels and Harley Payton, directed by Tim Hunter, those creative people and the performers in this episode are telling us that this is the case. So I think that whilst you're watching this episode, that's the truth of this episode.
Yeah.
You know, and But that might not be next week, you know? And I think that's learning to see it like that is quite difficult.
Just going back to what you were saying about, is the show letting them off the hook or, blah, blah, blah. I choose to believe that Bob is real, probably as much for my own mental health, because it's much easier to believe that Bob is real so that Leland isn't a terrible child abuser.
Well, it's almost like a self-defense mechanism, isn't it? Yeah. And,
I choose to believe that he's real for more than that. Like, I just do think he is. But...
Well, that's the other rewatch element as well, is watching this as a parent. Like, the moment where he sees Laura and he's like, oh, my angel.
Mm.
And I'm just like, oh, Christ. You know, it's like you any parent can get that and kind of understand that.
Yeah. Is it bringing back Dear Zachary vibes?
Well, yeah. It's that kind of thing. I mean, this is, and again, it makes it easier because you, and I think this is kind of what you're saying, I'm just approaching it from a different direction, is fantasy and genre gives you the comfort of distance. You know, it abstracts it. Mm. And in some ways, that's the great thing about art, is it makes thinking about things and talking about things and experiencing them easier, which is better than not confronting it at all.
Yeah.
You know, in the same way that things like, George Romero zombie movies are, rife with metaphor.
Yeah, of course.
Because... you're watching a zombie movie, so it's okay. It's just this silly thing. You know, Star Trek as well.
Star Trek does loads of stuff.
You know, you can think about and have conversations about terrorism without having to deal with the crushing depressiveness of the reality of it, you know. But you are still kind of swimming in that pond. Again, horror films, the appeal of horror films is... the same as a roller coaster. It's kind of controlled danger, controlled fear. There's a little bit of that going on here, because I think that if you were to just do a film about child abuse, it's kind of like, what are you achieving? We know it's horrible. Mm. So, what's the value in subjecting an audience to that? Mm. Unless you're going to use it for some larger... creative purpose. Mm. And I think that that's what you've got here. But I think ultimately, this episode is telling us that this is what's happened, that Leland was possessed. You know, he says it. He says, I didn't know I was doing it.
Mm.
And when it was over, I'd forgotten.
Yeah.
And
which kind of harks back to the whole dream state thing of, like, Cooper... needing to be in the roadhouse to remember the bits, Laura having dreams about, that's his dream state. Like, he's woken up from a nightmare, but he can't remember what the nightmare is.
And Albert says, exactly the same thing that Mark said in his feedback. It's like, people saw Bob, and I think it's important that they're having that conversation in broad daylight, because they're kind of bringing Bob into the daylight by having that conversation.
Yeah. Going,
no, hang on. This isn't just weird, spooky nighttime shit. Yeah. This has happened.
Yeah.
This is stuff that's occurred,
Yeah.
But again, David Lynch might come back in the next episode and go, I'm going to go over here now. And I think that that's the thing, is that if you want a kind of thesis, you're not going to get that from this show, And you don't want that. You might think you do, but...
what was the little moment you were going to say that comes back?
Mrs. Tremond at the end of season 3.
Oh, right. Oh, was that it?
Yeah.
All right.
And there's a moment there's the Chalfonts as well. You see it at the beginning of... in Fire Walk With Me as well, you see another family disappearing and then another version of the family being there and confusion around that. And you see a bit of that in Mulholland Drive as well, because Mulholland Drive was obviously a pilot for a TV show. Mm-hmm. It never happened, and then they released it theatrically instead. And
all that, I can remember from that is the girl singing "I Told Everyone Stuff."
but that was always meant to be in the same world as Twin Peaks. You can kind of see it heading in that direction. So we see that Truman is struggling with this. He says that.
Mm.
And a couple of the characters, Major Briggs and Truman, you know, well, what does it matter what we call it? And Cooper's like, well, we've got to stop it.
Yeah.
And I love the way that Briggs is like, yeah, and then just like wanders off into the woods. It's like, where's he going?
Yeah.
Like, well, we've lost it.
To stop it.
Yeah. So I'm going to go to work. You guys, he's, you know, been up
all night. You can't just all fanny around talking about whether Bob's real or not.
And Albert's like, maybe that's all he is, the evil that men do. And then Truman, you know, ever the pragmatist, says, well, okay, well, if he was real and we had him here and he got away, where is he now? And then we get this kind of crazy POV going through, like, foliage or, you know.
It's a real Voldemort moment.
Yeah, you know, it is, isn't it?
From the first one when he's drinking the unicorn blood.
Yeah. And then we see an owl, not what it seems, fly out. And then we pause and go to end credits. Any final thoughts, Hannah, before we wrap up and talk about what we're going to be doing next time?
Just like a masterclass in acting from Ray Wise, and I thoroughly enjoyed watching his performance again. I'm really interested to see how I enjoy the next half, basically, of season two on rewatch. I'm looking forward to it. I really am.
Yeah. I think you will have a great time with it. I really do. This is a great episode. It's one of the best episodes of the show, I think. And as much as I talk about loving the, you know, the vibiness and the ambiguity of David Lynch, there is something very satisfying about seeing the puzzle pieces kind of fall into place.
Yeah.
And you know, kind of getting rewarded and knowing that we weren't being bullshitted.
Yeah.
You know, and I'm sure that there was a lot of figuring it out afterwards and happy accidents. That's the way that Lynch and Frost work. But hell, I bought it. I bought what they were selling. So what are we talking about next time, Hannah?
Okay, so the next episode is called Dispute Between Brothers. Leland is laid to rest and Sarah Palmer tries to accept all that has happened to her family. Dr. Jacoby returns from Hawaii.
Jacoby, God, I forgot about him.
Cooper prepares to leave Twin Peaks. Mayor Milford objects to his brother's engagement to a younger woman. It is directed by Tina Rathbone and written by Trisha Brock.
Bring on the ridiculous subplots. I'm ready for it. Bring on
the Trish.
All right, then. We will be talking to you about that episode of Twin Peaks very soon. So farewell, one and all.
See you later.